Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Catch with John Fisher on Blog Talk Radio, connecting life to faith.
World is trying to get it together, trying to help their fellow man, hoping we can make it.
In 1970, we were trying to figure out whether we could make it better, and there was a lot of disillusionment. A lot of people thought we couldn't, and then Jesus showed up, and we called it the Jesus Movement, and things changed dramatically, maybe not politically, but they changed in people's hearts and minds, and a lot of people have been following Jesus ever since. And I'm just one of those old Jesus guys who has stayed that way all my life. And I have this catch of the day. It's called The Catch, and you can sign up for it at catchjohnfisher.com, and you'll get something fresh from me every morning. I write it every day, 5 days a week. And we're doing I'm doing some Advent writing right now. We're writing about Christmas as we're getting ready for the season. And that's just one small thing we do. We've got all kinds of things going on. We have a prayer ministry going on. We have training sessions. We've got study materials. And then, of course, we got the Blog Talk Radio every Tuesday night. And because of that, we've got a great backlog of incredible shows and amazing guests. You can go back there and you can find Oz Guinness and Tony Campo and Frank Schaefer. It's really been fun to get some pretty well-known people and then some not so well-known people. Some people I don't even know who've been recommended that I've had the chance to meet. But most of all, I like to tell, I usually tell everybody, this is a fun time for me. This is a fun hour for me because I feel like I get to share some of my favorite people with my group, which those of you who are following The Catch. I get to share these people with you, and they're people I've been privileged to get to know over the years. And I had this great fantasy that we're going to all sit around a stone fireplace somewhere, and we're just going to talk. Man, spend the whole weekend, you know, and but I guess that's heaven. I'm sure they got a stone fireplace in heaven, and we're going to sit there and talk. But right now, I get to talk every Tuesday night with somebody I want you to meet. So tonight, let's get right down to it. A guest who I met during the time when I was doing a lot of traveling in the beginning, doing my music, and later speaking in Christian colleges. And our guest was a dean at Laterno College, where I was at a number of times, still go back. And then he was president at what time was Southwestern University, mm-hmm. And now it's Arizona Christian University.
You got it.
And is that right, Brent? This is welcome,
yep.
Brent Garrison, folks.
Well, thank you, and, John. And we do go way back.
Yeah, I know. You know what? I had forgotten, Brent, that you were at Laterno.
Yeah, so, I was at Laterno 78 to 84, and then I went to Moody, John, for 11 years in Chicago.
Yeah. So where did I first meet you? Do you remember?
Would
it have been Laterno?
I vividly remember. I was dean of students at Laterno, and I had the responsibility of signing up special speakers, and you spoke at Ringgold, Louisiana, at the Bible Memory Camp there with our students.
Oh,
79.
Yeah.
79,
wow.
79 or 80, I think.
Woo, man.
Yeah, we're getting old, John.
Jeez, that's incredible. Well, yeah. then you've been at Moody, too. And, of course, I've been there a number of times. And You know, a lot of our listeners might not know that about a third of my travel, when I was traveling more than I am now, about a third of it was spent in Christian colleges. And so I'm very familiar with the Christian college, and I really wanted to talk about that for a little bit because, Brent, you've got kind of looks like two parts of your career. And there, that first part was in Christian higher education. And then now you're working with CEOs. We'll get into that a little bit later. But for I think something like 32 years, you were in Christian higher education. Primarily, I'm interested in the fact that you were president of what is now Arizona Christian College for, what, 16 years? Is that right?
Yeah, 15.
Yeah,
15. Yeah, don't make it any longer than it was.
Well,
you know, John, so, basically college presidents at private colleges are fundraisers, so it's not that glorious of a job.
Well, I sure enjoyed you when you were there, and I enjoyed that you, I think we connected, and I think you had a heart for what I was doing, and I always feel good when somebody is bringing me in, not because, this is John Fisher, he's got a bunch of records or something like that, but no, you're bringing me in because you know what I'm going to teach your students, and you want them to be exposed to that, and that is really, really encouraging, and so I wanted to just talk about that. With all those years in Christian colleges are a real anomaly, you know, and of course we've got Christian day school and Christian regular schools, grammar schools, high schools, and then all of you can do the whole thing, all in a Christian environment. What do you think, Brent, are some of the, well, let's start about the best things. What are some of the strengths of a Christian education, a Christian higher education especially? What would you say some of the
five. Yeah, and I think we need to set it up with a little bit of history in colleges in America, particularly. I mean, probably most of your listeners realize that the Ivy League schools were started by faith groups, be it Baptists or, mm-hmm. or Congregationalists or Presbyterian. So, you know, the Princetons and Harvards and Yales and others were started by people of faith. And over a period of time, they became what we call liberal or secular, and that's why there was the rising up of other colleges to kind of take the place of the original mission of these schools in America. So that's kind of the conundrum we're in, the worldview fight. But I do think there are a lot of advantages to Christian higher ed, and then we will talk about some of the very significant negative ones too. But I just wrote down a couple here, John. Hopefully this mm-hmm. kind of yeah. answers your question. I would regularly share with faculty in my role the wonderful passage out of Luke chapter 6, verse 40. When a student is fully trained, he becomes like his teacher. And so I think that's huge. I mean, that's a number one to me as a parent. I want my kids, and I have four children and five grandkids, I want my kids to be around people of faith, also of intellect and of character mm-hmm. and virtue. And I think there's a stronger likelihood of mm-hmm. a kid being exposed to that kind of faculty in a Christian university rather than a secular one. So, again, that's huge. Mm-hmm. Number two, this is an incredible time in a student's, in a young person's life. And John, again, you've given many decades to this, but it's a time when they make career decisions, they make life partner decisions, and probably most important, they literally are making faith their own at this time, because now they're underneath the role of mom and dad. They're on their own. They're growing up. They're thinking on their own. They're being exposed to a number of different concepts and ideas. Parents can't control them as much anymore. So again, the role of a Christian university is very critical there, because parents, for the most part, can at least feel better, not completely trust, but feel better about what they're going to be exposed to at a Christian school rather than a secular mm-hmm. school. 'Cause, and John, I think you'd agree with this. even the public schools have dramatically changed in the last 30 years from what they were when we were. I went to Indiana University 1970 to 75. So it's a completely different place than it was in 1970. So that's another one, very critical time in life. This is another one that I'm sure you've thought of, but probably our listeners haven't. I think, frankly, there's greater academic freedom in a Christian university than in a secular university today. And I could give an example of that. Because at a Christian school, we will talk about everything. Nothing's off the table. Where at a secular school, everything's pretty much in lockstep. In fact, we've all heard of stories where a student maybe writes something in a blue book or a paper that doesn't go along with the liberal mindset or view, and they're disciplined for it, or the grade is not given to them that it should be. Where at Christian universities, I felt there was always an openness to talk about all ideas. Now, yeah, we'd come down on the Christian front, but there was an openness to talk about them at least. So anyway, do you want to take a minute that I can share a dramatic example of this, or don't we have time to do that?
No, please
on
do.
On academic freedom.
Of course.
John, some years ago, I was chairing an accrediting team visit to a school in Southern California. It was a Christian university. It was trying to get WACS accreditation, which is the regional accreditation in California. And so there was our team, a Christian group, and then there was a team from WACS, which was there also to validate their move toward accreditation, regional accreditation. So after a day together, the two teams get together to talk about the day of interviews and everything else. And so the other group, the other team said, wow, I can't believe the lack of academic freedom at this school and blah, 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 blah. Well, I listened to enough of that until I got sick of it. I finally said, okay, let me ask you this. What if I was teaching science in your university? Would you permit me as a PhD scientist to teach all cosmological views of the origin of the universe? Or are you going to only insist that I talk about the naturalist view? Well, that was the end of that conversation, quite frankly, because they knew that was a checkmate. And we even talked about it, because that is true. You know, you're not going to talk about the possibility of God created, or ID, or intelligent design, for example. So that was a real, real example to this type of thing from my career.
Wow.
I think too, another one here is it helps answer the four big questions of life. And everybody's got to answer these, John. It's, you know, it's absolutely critical that whether you're a person of faith or not, that you at least have some perspective of the four big questions of origin. Where did I come from? Purpose. Why am I here? Values. What will I value in my life? And then finally, destiny. Where will I go after I die? And I think that's another critical role that a Christian university can play in helping give a biblical perspective of those four questions. And how are those things going to be answered in a secular context? You know, you're an animal.
Yeah.
You know. So I think those are hitting some of the big ones, if I could suggest.
Yeah. Boy, you just pulled out all the questions, my favorite questions out of Blade Runner. Where can we come from? Where are we going? And how long have we got?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, that's interesting that you say that the Christian college is more open. I'm not sure. Well, I think Christian colleges that you were in charge of, maybe, but I wonder about everybody. Now, let me.
That would be true. There would be
some
that would be very narrow-minded. Yeah.
Or here's the thing. If in a Christian college we're going to study Islam, we would have. There are a lot of Christians that would not have a devout Muslim come and talk to their students. They would probably have a Muslim who had converted to Christianity would then come and talk to their students.
Yeah, that's probably true.
I
wouldn't have any problem with that, and you wouldn't either, with
right.
having a Muslim come in and share.
Yeah, that's what I think separates some. I could almost separate schools by the ones, you know, the ones who would allow, would welcome, you know, or welcome the homosexual to come in and speak and about gay issues, or welcome the, you know, the person who's, you know, for abortions, and talk openly in the school, and let's expose ourselves to this, and not just someone who has changed, but who are in, you know, set in that position, so that we, otherwise, how are we going to function in the real world if we don't know what these people are saying, you know, and,
well,
how do we talk with them? You've
hit the great weakness of a Christian university, and that's that if it can be a greenhouse where everyone is kind of believing the same thing. But again, that's another topic, too. You know, we'll talk about those weaknesses in a minute, but I think you're right. I'm with you, though. I always felt like if the faith that we have so enjoyed and been honored to be part of doesn't have the power and authority to be able to stand up against other worldviews, other ideas, then we've got a weak faith. Our faith is a strong, it is a defendable faith. It is a apologetic-based faith. It's not just feelings and things. So I think I wouldn't have any problem with having those people come in and being exposed to us.
Do you think, here's a question. Now, this may not, of course, you 15 years, you saw things shift a lot during that time, I'm sure. But would you say, over the bulk of the time, would you say that the faculty was generally more open-minded than the students, or the other way around? What would you say? Generally, it's a very general question.
That is, and I haven't given much thought to it. So this is just going to be an off-the-cuff answer.
Yeah,
to that.
I threw you this one.
I think again, because the students coming in today compared to 30 years ago has shifted so dramatically. And one example. The student that's coming into a Christian college today thinks nothing of the homosexual issue. They think it's stupid that we even have a discussion about it. It's settled in their minds. 30 years ago, that was not the case. So that's just one illustration. So that the faculty that are there today, for the most part, still would adhere to a biblical worldview of sexuality, where the student's coming in. So there's one example. I think that's probably true in other areas, too. So to answer it, I think generally the students would be more open-minded than the faculty. Also, John, let's face it. We're in our 60s. At least I think you are. You're older than me.
I am.
And I think as we get older, we change, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, you get some mileage on the odometer, and what we thought we had figured out 25 years ago, we're saying, well, maybe. And we become more definitive in some areas and maybe a little bit more open-minded in other areas as we grow older.
That's right. That's so true.
At least that's my case. That's my situation.
What do you think? Okay, we already touched upon this, but what do you think are some of the weaknesses of a Christian college?
It's not a real life situation. Let's face it. It's not the crucible of life. It is protective, and again, that's why parents often like it, because they feel at least there's a few more years of protection for Johnny and Mary. In reality, though, again, that's changed dramatically over the last 30 years. Christian colleges are very much secular in many ways. Again, compared to the rest of the world, not so much. But so it's not a real life situation. It's somewhat unrealistic. And you know what? I don't think Christian universities or colleges are for every young person. I think if you have a son or daughter that really are strong in their faith, they've got it. I mean, they thrive in an environment where they're being questioned about their faith, and they do well. I think it's a disservice to send them to a Christian school. But in fact, what typically happens is most of the time is the kid goes to secular or a public school from K to high school, and then the parent wants them to be grounded in a college, a Christian college. I think it ought to be the other way around. I think that maybe if you're going to do Christian school, you ought to do it K through 12 and then put them into the public arena, having prepared them apologetically wise, reading Og Guinness and C.S. Lewis and others, preparing them. And then say, hey, go on out there, start living your faith and talking about your faith and defending your faith. So that's one. And then the other thing is you mentioned it in your notes to me, the complacency issue. I do think there is an issue of Christian complacency. Well, I'm living with Christians. I have Christian teachers.
Right.
You kind of let your guard down a little bit, and and the faith becomes less. In fact, when I went to cemetery, we kidded with one another. We're at cemetery. You've heard that before, you know, where you're studying the Bible all the time. You're talking about theological issues. Well, all of a sudden, it becomes a text or an academic subject rather than a relationship. So that can happen, too. And again, the other reality is just because it's a Christian university doesn't mean that it's a panacea. It's certainly not. It reflects the culture in every sense. So for parent, don't think this is a panacea. It's going to reflect the culture. You can't protect your child forever.
But it
and
is
you probably
true,
add to that list, John. Add to that list, though. You probably have seen, because you've been in so many different schools, you probably got a better perspective than even I do.
Well, I think the whole idea of the fact that most everybody is a Christian really weakens individual faith. I think there's something about, you know, corporate faith, which is good. We get together in chapel and we feel something really good, you know, together. But no one really, like you say, no one is really being questioned. No one has to really have their own relationship with God. There's so much that's assumed. Everybody is assumed that they had their devotions today. Everybody is assumed they're praying all the time, and all of that. And you know, to a large part, many of them aren't even bothering at all with their spiritual life. So they're basically kind of being spiritual by osmosis and thinking that they're around it all the time. And I think there's a pretty high rate of kids losing their faith when they get out of a Christian college. I think I've heard some statistics. I don't know what the current ones are, but you know, I always say, well, if you lost it when you left the Christian college, I would say you probably never had it. That's the problem, you know.
You never
owned it. It was never yours. And to me, that is the struggle at a Christian college, to make your faith your own and not just kind of glide along with everybody else.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, G.K. Chesterton's one of my favorite authors, and I'm going to botch this quote, but, you know, it's not that the Christian faith has been tried and found wanting, but it's been tried and found difficult. Our faith must be... Our faith really typically only grows when it's in the crucible, when it's being challenged. You know, the other night, I have a neighbor who's a young guy, IT specialist, works out of his home as I do in Phoenix, and he texted me the other night and he said, Brent, you want to have a beer with me? And I said, yeah, let's meet out in my garage. I have kind of a little man cave out in my garage, and so he came over and. It was a wonderful time because I realized I need more of that interaction with people who are not believers to keep my sword sharp. It was a really wonderful evening, very energizing. And I trust that he was impacted because he was able to see a man who had passion for his faith and had real answers for his questions. So that's where our faith really begins to grow in the crucible of interacting with other people.
Yeah, and I think, I think that's in a way that's another problem at a Christian college is that we end up not knowing how to talk to people. You know, we talk to everybody who is already in our camp, but what if they're not? How do you talk to them? And, you know, we have this
idea. Christians for years have had this idea of how different we are. And and that difference a lot of times is really an isolation from the world. And it's from, you know, we're coded by all of our own stuff, what we do and don't do and the way we think and the way we believe, and we're all similar in everything. We are, you know, we're all Republicans or whatever. And and then you get outside of that box and you go, well, who are you? I mean, how do I even carry on a conversation with a person like this? I haven't learned that actually I haven't learned the things that make me similar, the things that make me alike non-Christians.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
We were always trying to be different. And I say, hey, hold it. It's time to start to be like non-Christians, because that's how else are we going to bring them to the Lord if we don't connect with them, if we don't see what we have in common, you know? And that's
well,
and
John, we have a perfect example of that in Christ's life. I mean, he was criticized by the religious aristocracy for interacting with sinners, and he came to seek and to save that which is lost. And that should be our role in life as well, is these precious people that don't know Christ, their lives literally can be transformed by a relationship with Christ. I mean, our life has been transformed. So why would we not want that for them as well? They're dealing with very challenging issues like, where did I come from? What's my purpose? What do I value? And where am I going? And what answers is the world? What answers is the world giving them? It's the media and pop culture is unbelievable.
Yeah. Wow, that's so true.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think the thing that brought us together, I think, is this whole idea of worldview. But I think that there's, you know, worldview in academic situations sometimes is different than outside of that. Worldview is a huge term, and it means different things to different folks. How would you define a person's worldview?
Well, I like simple, John. I think simple really helps. So, you know, when you boil the Bible down to one topic, it's relationship. We were created to relate with our God. We blew it. He sent his son that we might have a new relationship. If we boil the Ten Commandments down to one topic, it's stealing something, his day, the truth, somebody's wife. I mean, simple, simple, simple. Worldview is, therefore, what you believe. And what you believe about the four questions of life. Where'd you come from? What's your purpose here on earth? What are you going to value? And where are you going to go? Every single person, how many billion are there now, John? 6.5 billion people. They all have a worldview. And then those worldviews can be broken into two columns. There's a God, there's a deity, or there's no deity. Okay, now on the one column, if there is a God, how are you going to define that deity? What kind of a deity is he?
Mm-hmm.
Then you kind of subset that. But other than that, that's it. There's a God, or there's a deity, there's a supreme power, or there's nothing. I'm just natural. You know, I'm a product of evolutionary chance. So that's what I like is simple. Everybody's got to deal with those four questions. And so that's worldview to me. Now, maybe that's too simple for you, but that's kind of works for me.
No, that's cool. What could you go over those questions one more time? Where did I come from? What do I value? What is that?
Yeah, origin. Where did I come from?
Origin. Okay.
And then purpose. Why am I here?
Purpose.
And then values. You know, because I may figure out my purpose, but values is living out a purpose. That's why three or four values. And then finally, destiny. You know, where do I go at the end of life? And, I don't know. I don't know our listeners, but origin for people of faith is pretty simple.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that God created. Mm-hmm. But you know what? Most of the world doesn't believe that. And that's a huge one. If you don't start with the first one being answered correctly, the other three are going to be answered incorrectly. Does that make sense? You got to start with an origin, and because then your purpose, and the Westminster Catechism. What was it? The chief end of man.
Mm-hmm.
Real simple. to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever.
Mm-hmm.
So recognizing who He is, and then out of that recognition and relationship, I enjoy life at a much higher level because I have a relationship with the one that created me.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's great. That's a simple answer. Four questions, they've got to be answered. Everybody's answering them one way or another.
Well, I like the way you're defining worldview because it cuts across religions and politics and all that stuff. You know,
yeah.
for a lot of people think that worldview is us versus them. You know, it's what we believe as Christians versus what the world believes. And
yeah,
so Christian worldview, I really get worried. I get a little leery when Christians start talking about Christian worldview because I a lot of times I'm afraid what they mean is Christian worldview is how we think as Christians, what we think is important, what we think matters, you know,
mm-hmm.
And not able to have a view that has God over all things and has, you know, where you can find God is as much in the secondary university as you can in the Christian one. And,
yep.
And, you know, so I think a lot of Christians' worldview is a little small. And
absolutely.
What you're talking
absolutely, yeah. It encompasses every aspect of life. And the other thing I think we forget that everybody does have a worldview. We think sometimes as Christians we're the only ones that have a worldview. Well, that's not true. Everybody in the world has a view of how the world runs and how they're going to live their life. Now, you may not agree with that as a Christian. That's where the rub comes, John. And I think the problem often is the church. And in fact, Dean Merrill, I don't know if you know that name, used to work for Focus, but he wrote a wonderful little paperback that I have taught from, I have read several times. The name of it is Christians are Sinners in the Hands of an Angry Church.
I love
and not, you know, the old spinoff of the Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. No, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry Church. And the premise of Dean's book was, Church, why in the world do you look at the world the way you do? They're just being the world, for goodness sake. And so don't be angry at them. Don't be upset with them. Don't be gnarly with them. Be gracious and merciful with them because but by grace there go I. And I love that because I've tried to live that way. I don't want people to meet me and go, boy, that guy's gnarly. I want them to be attracted to my love and my radiance of Christ and my patience and, you know, all the attributes that Jesus had.
I'm reminded of a bumper sticker I saw once that said, I'm for the separation of church and hate.
The same idea, isn't it?
Isn't
because
that
I think that's one of the problems that the world looks at the Christian church and they think we're a bunch of haters and yes, I disagree with your lifestyle, but I love you because you're precious in God's sight.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I disagree with that. But that's not how I'm going to perceive you. I don't want you to perceive me as a hater of you. I want you to perceive me as a lover who's trying to live his life in relationship to what he understands about his God. Now, that's my problem, not your problem.
Yeah. And see, what I think, Brent, is that we can't be in a totally Christian environment with this wall between us and the world and say all these things about, well, we really do love those people over there. You know, you have to get over the wall and get in relationship with them if you're going to love them. That you don't know what you're talking about otherwise. Don't you agree?
Absolutely. In fact, John, you probably remember the early church, one of the reasons it became the sanctioned church in the Roman Empire by the 4th century, it was because the early church was living out their faith in love. I mean, there are stories in church history where Christians stayed and cared for those in the plague. I mean, it's crazy stuff, and people were impacted because of the way they loved people in dire circumstances. well, how in the world have we lost that today? And I think, therefore, we've lost our power as the church. Because, again, that's what people really... D. James Kennedy wrote a wonderful book before he died, What If Jesus Had Never Been Born? And it outlines kind of the impact of Christianity as it moves into a culture and education and healthcare and women's issues and on and on and on. And let's face it, followers of Christ, this faith that we are living is a powerful force for good, and it's changed cultures and countries for the good. And yet we're being attacked.
Yeah.
It's almost like we're the problem today. Well, wait a minute, you know.
Yeah.
But we've lost our power. We've lost our power, particularly in American culture.
Yeah, well, I think that's another discussion, right? I think we, you know, we got involved in politics and we gave up a lot of that power when we did that. And that was a huge mistake because now we can't speak into the culture anymore. The church, and, you know, the church should be countercultural, but we became part of the culture. And, well, that's not what we're going to talk about.
That's another book, John. That's another book you can write.
That's another book, yeah. But now, oh, gosh, time is flying by here. I want to hear what you're doing now. Somehow you switched from students to CEOs. You know, that's a big jump. Tell us about that.
Well, in a nutshell, John, as I said earlier, I was president of a Christian college in Phoenix for 15 years, and I kind of woke up. I was realizing then I was moving towards 60 real fast, and I said, man, if I'm going to make a change, I better do it pretty soon, because once you're over 60, you know, people kind of look at you like, well, are you still alive? And as I said earlier too, I was tired of just asking for money all the time. That was a big role as a president. And
and
I did that well, I think. And I, you know, the college benefited through what I had done, but it was time for a change. So, you know, the chairman of my board was a CEO of a large corporation, and he was part of this group of CEO forum that started originally in Focus on the Family 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so he approached me and said, hey, they're looking for somebody to work for CEO. So for the long and the short of it, we interviewed and God opened the door, and it has been a hoot. I'm so honored to to do what I do, to love and pray for and interact with a Christian CEOs at the highest level in business in America.
Wow. Well, tell us some more about that. What does it mean? How does it work out? You know, what's the forum all about?
This goes back to worldview, John. I think the church is blown it here too. And again, we're not banging on the church tonight. The church is Jesus Christ died and set up this thing called the church so that it could impact the world. The church is to be a place of teaching and edification and encouragement, and then to go out into the world and impact it. And we've been talking about how we've kind of pulled away from the world, and we've made our own little enclaves of Christianity, which, again, is not what Christ wanted in the first place. So when you go, a CEO goes to a church, typically, he's going to hear often today negative things about if you're a wealthy person or if you're a powerful person.
Mm.
We don't talk an awful lot in the church about living your faith in the marketplace. In fact, there's kind of a dichotomy, the secular and the sacred, right? And that's very powerful yet today. So our mission is to challenge these wonderful leaders that we work with to be kingdom advancers in the marketplace. God has placed them in very strategic high roles in the business world. Now, here's the other thing that's exciting. Most people aren't waking up on Sunday morning. Mr. You know, Jim isn't waking up and saying, Sarah, we know to go to church today. They're not doing that. I mean, at least that's not been my experience. Someone has to interact with them, invite them to church or live their faith. Well, where better than in the marketplace where you spend most of your life?
Mm-hmm.
So marketplace ministry, Dr. David Miller is a Princeton professor, wrote a wonderful book called God at Work. If any of your listeners are interested in reading more about the marketplace ministry world, Princeton University has a division, a department that studies and teaches about God and work.
No kidding.
And Dr. David Miller is a member of the forum and just a dear, dear brother in the Lord, and you know, PhD and all the good stuff. But he was in the business world for a while in London, and God just laid it upon his heart for this marketplace ministry. Another name that some of our listeners might know is Henry Blackaby, the Experiencing God.
Yeah.
And he's written quite a bit about the marketplace, because Henry believes that the next revival could well happen in the marketplace through business leaders. It's typically happened in colleges and universities, but he believes if God's Spirit moves again, it's going to be through the marketplace. So that's
cool.
Our role, to challenge these people to live out their faith in the marketplace, and it's pretty cool to watch light bulbs come on, frankly.
Mm. I've got to detail mine, so I'm trying to see how this works. Can you give us just a little idea of how that happens? How many people have involved, and how does it work?
Yeah, there are over 200 members of the forum right now, and criteria to join, naturally a person of faith, but running a company of a certain size, and I'm not going to share that on the listeners, but it's a very substantial size. And because we've kind of set that criteria of larger companies, we literally we have the privilege of working with some of the largest Fortune companies in America. And it's amazing how God places people of faith in corporate America. And then our role is to challenge them to live that out. So we've developed a curriculum called the Spiritual Leadership Institute. It's a 3-year program. There's mentoring involved in it, or discipleship in it, and it challenges them to kind of live out their faith. They're discipled by another leader who's gone through that program, who's in the business world, so they're able to talk the same language. The other thing is that each of them are assigned a staff member, such as myself, and we regularly contact them to encourage them, to pray for them, to disciple them, to really whatever they feel they need to encourage them to live out their faith. And because, I mean, John, imagine you're running a multi-billion-dollar international company. How many people, direct reports or the like, can you talk to about your faith, about personal issues, and feel you have a confidant? It's a huge role that we play there in their lives, of loving on them, praying for them. And what a ministry, what an idea, what a concept. And then they take these ideas and they say, okay, how do I live out my faith in the marketplace? Some of them hire chaplains from Corporate Chaplains of America, for example, in Atlanta. They are specifically seminary trained people. They're specifically trained in what they can and cannot do in the marketplace. Others of our people are setting up Bible studies in their place. Others have set up funds that if everybody, one place in Houston, one company, he gives them all their regular vacation, but then he adds an extra week to do missional work. Now, you don't have to be a Christian. Anything that's a passion.
Yeah.
And then they set up a fund to help pay your transportation and ancillary expenses to do that mission work. And it has exploded opportunities to talk about belief, the four questions in that company. So these are just some of the ideas that these leaders spin off as they consider how to live out their faith in the marketplace.
Wow, that's great. Now, what I was reading on the website a little bit about the forums. That's like you have
We do not have a public website. So if you were reading something, you were reading another CEO forum. Our website really is not encrypted, but it's got a password to get into it, because it's primarily used for our people to interact with one another. So sorry, you got the wrong website.
Okay. So it sounds like your thing is much more grassroots relational. Is that right?
100%.
Across the board.
100%. 100%.
Wow.
We don't advertise for members. It's all word of mouth. It's probably the most exciting ministry I've had in my life, John. And it's just opened my eyes to the opportunities in the marketplace to live out your faith boldly. And it's probably the last place that we can in the culture today. You know, the media world, pop culture has pretty much been lost. Higher education's been pretty much lost. Politics pretty much lost. But the business world still, there's still a real openness to how can you help your employees be the best that they possibly can? And study after study after study is coming out showing that allowing them to exercise their beliefs, their worldview, whatever that might be, is a very, very helpful thing. So we just happen to be encouraging the Christian worldview, naturally.
That harkened back a little bit to what Oz Guinness talked to us about, what he calls soul freedom, that we got to allow everybody to have, regardless of what they believe. That's very cool. Well, you know, our time is kind of coming short here. I'm thinking as you're talking to these guys, they're out in the world. Try and work this down. You know, there aren't many CEOs probably listening to us right now. We're the regular folks that do whatever we do. How does this work for us? What would you say to us in terms of maintaining our Christian faith in the marketplace where we work, where we live, in our neighborhoods, where we're, I know that's a huge question, but maybe a couple things that will key into your mind that you might want to be thinking about.
In fact, I'm so passionate about this, John, I could go on and on and on, which I know I don't have time, but two places. Number one, I'm a seminary grad. I've been in ministry my whole life. I've taught Bible and theology and world religions, and yet too long in my life did I overlook John 15, the first 10 verses. And you know the passage, you know, the true vine, my father's the gardener, he cuts every branch that bears no fruit. Read that passage, listeners. It is one of the most powerful, meaningful passages in the New Testament. It's this whole idea of abiding means simply to be in proximity with. If we as followers of Christ consciously stay in connection with Christ through his word, through prayer, through encouragement and fellowship with other like-minded believers, there's a strength in that. There's a purpose in that. Brother Lawrence, years ago, wanted to live his life in 24/7 in connected with the Father in prayer. Well, that's a great goal, isn't it? So abiding, I just can't overemphasize that. You start the day with a few moments reflecting upon God's word in prayer and asking this Holy Spirit to guide and lead you. It's amazing the difference in your day rather than rushing off. And this is a huge one with our CEOs because they're so type A driven, get it done people that when they finally do slow down and invite the Father into their lives, it's a powerful change. The other passage is in 2 Corinthians 3. I don't know about you, but I tell you, the Corinth church was a mess, just like so many churches today. And having been to Corinth, you know, you look up on the hill and you see the temple of Aphrodite and the 1,000 temple prostitutes. I mean, talk about a tough church plant, John, right in the middle of that godless culture. Paul writes to these precious brothers, you yourselves are letters. Chapter 3, 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 2. You yourselves are our letter, written on our hearts, known and read by everybody. You show that you are a letter from Christ, the result of our ministry, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God. Not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of human hearts. In a nutshell, what Paul's saying to these brothers and sisters, be living letters. In other words, most of the people that are around you will never pick up a Bible. They'll never read a verse, but they will read your life, your words, your motive, your work ethic, your love. Be living letters, brothers and sisters. This world desperately needs to see us living our faith authentically. It is very appealing when it's lived with authenticity. People go, wow, what is it about you that's different?
And wow.
As it says in Peter, a reason for the hope that's within you. I mean, literally.
Mm-hmm.
So living letters and abide. There are the two ideas as we close.
Wow. Wow. That's fantastic, Brent. And that's perfect, and you picked one of my favorite passages in 2 Corinthians. So That's
really
perfect. We call that the new covenant, the new covenant ministry, and you know, I keep teaching that all the time in terms of the fact that we are simply the place, we're the vessel where the work goes on, and in order for the power to be seen, we have to be seen. It's not there's nothing to hide. We have to be no veils. We're transparent, you know, and people see the whole thing. They see the struggles, but they also see the hope, and that's so cool.
Well, and John, too, just a couple chapters later, if I might, another passage that's so powerful in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, going by verse 16 and following, that we are called to be ambassadors of Christ and to reconcile the world to God. And are we doing that? How do we do that? By being hateful and ugly and mean-spirited rather than loving and patient and kind and serving. I mean, This is cool stuff we're talking about, and as we live this out, it's a powerful moving force across the nation.
Wow, it sure is. Well, Brent, fantastic. Thank you so much for being with us.
My joy.
This has been great, and we'll be praying for you and your ministry with CEOs. I'm so excited. It's kind of, you must feel like you're kind of under the radar out there. Probably a little bit. Does it feel like that?
it's a low key. I mean, it's
that's
not about
great.
Us, and I like that. Mm-hmm. I want to. Our goal is to minister to the lives of these leaders. God has positioned them in special places. We want to come alongside and encourage them in their faith.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, I'm really glad God put you there. I'm glad that I know you and. Pray God's blessing on you. Thank you very much, Brent.
John, blessings to you this Christmas season.
Thank you.
Thanks for the honor of being interviewed.
And Merry Christmas.
Thank you, John.
All right. Yeah.